The definition of yoga, which means union with the infinite spirit, the Patanjali's classic definition in Sanskrit is yogis chitta vritti nirodh, which means yoga, union with God, comes when the vrittis, whirlpools of feeling located in the heart, are entirely calm. Then union is automatic. Now we have to appreciate in the practice of yoga, from the start, yoga by this, I don't mean yoga postures, but yoga as the science of God realization, of self-realization, that it isn't anything that we have to acquire. If I wanted to become an electrical engineer, there's a tremendous amount of information about how things work that I just don't have. I would have to spend a great deal of time studying, and facts and knowledge would have to be brought into me from the outside. It's not inherent, at least not within me. It wouldn't be a recognition of my own nature. But the path of realization on the spiritual path is actually what they call smriti. Smriti is a really wonderful word. It means divine memory. And progress on the spiritual path is known as the awakening of smriti, which is we cease to forget what we really are, and we begin to remember what we really are. Just exactly as if when you're acting in a play, let's say, and you get so lost in the part that for a time you really forget that you have any other reality except the reality that you're playing out, or you're singing a song and the feeling of the song is so moving to you that you weep from the loss that the song might be expressing, even though there's no real loss happening in your life, but you just forget where our real life comes from. And so the whole process of entering into the ego and living in this body as a human being is that it's a state of forgetfulness, that we actually believe that we are born, that we die, that we suffer. I was so moved by a story I read in a doctor's book about terminally ill patients. And one of her patients was very, very afraid of dying. And much of her work with him was trying to get him to accept what was happening. And then all of a sudden there was a tremendous change just a few days before he died. And he explained it to her in very simple terms. He said he had a dream or a vision. He didn't know what it was exactly. But he had a true experience in which he was lying in his bed, which he was unable to leave now because he was so weak. And he actually could see the edges of this state of creation. He could see that there was a boundary line to the material world, and that all around it was this subtle world of spirit, that the material world was just an extension of that. And he realized that when he left his physical body, he would just move across that boundary line into the spiritual world. And that the most remarkable thing about that experience to him was that when he saw it, he remembered it. It wasn't as if he learned it. It was that he realized when he saw that edge that it had always been there, and that somehow he'd gotten so confused that he no longer recalled that it was there. He said to her, the doctor, he said, "Now I can't see the edge anymore." He said, "It sort of is somewhere behind the headboard of the bed. And every time I try to turn, I just can't quite turn around far enough to see it right now." He said, "But I have absolute certainty that it's there." And it's completely changed his entire relationship to leaving this world, because all he's doing, he said, is going back to where I came from. It's just that I got so involved here, I forgot. Now that, in the essence of it, is what smriti is. There's a marvelous story that Swamiji often tells, sometimes tells, about Krishna and his companion Narada. And Narada and Krishna are walking across a field, across a desert, actually, and Narada is speaking to Krishna, and he says, "Krishna, I find this so confusing. How is it that when souls incarnate, and merely by taking a physical body and assuming the responsibilities of an ego, they become so forgetful of the divine reality? How can it be that the Maya that you have created is so bewitching that they can't see through it?" Krishna made no response, but just listened attentively to Narada's question. And then he said, "Narada, I see in the distance a village over there." He said, "This is a long and a hot walk, and I'm becoming thirsty. I'd like to rest here a moment, and perhaps you could go to that village and come back with a glass of water for me." And Narada said, Lord, of course, whatever you like, because Narada's the servant of the Lord. So he went off to that little village. And when he got to the village, he went to the first house he saw, and the door was opened by a beautiful young woman. And all of a sudden, Narada could only think how lovely she was and how meaningful it would be to him to spend time with her and to become close with her, to become her friend. And he met her father, and the father saw Narada as an upright and handsome young stranger who'd come to their village, but he was happy to take him into his home. And before very long, a marriage was arranged between the young girl and Narada. And Narada was thrilled to have this beautiful spiritual woman as his bride, and the village helped them set up their own little hut. And in the course of time, 1, 2, and 3 children were born, and Narada tilled the fields, and everything was going so beautifully. And then one terrible day, a storm came, and as sometimes happens in the desert, a flash flood arose. And 12 years had passed, and now the children were growing up, and Narada was living this wonderful life, and this flash flood came, and all of a sudden, first his hut was washed away, and then he saw his fields flooded, and then he grabbed his wife and his 3 children, and he had one child on his shoulder and one child in his hand, and the wife was carrying one of the children. He was holding his wife's hand, and they're walking through the flood, and the waters are rising, and suddenly the waters knocked the child off his shoulder, and when that babe went away, the mother let go of the hand of one of her children, and she reached for the baby, but she couldn't reach the baby, and she was drawn under the water, and Narada reached for the wife and then let go of the child, and all 3 of the children were lost, and the wife was lost, and Narada himself just gave up. And he just let the waters take him. And then not long after, he hears someone calling his name, Narada, 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 like this. He opens his eyes and he sees all this sort of expanse of brown, and he thinks it's the muddy flood waters, and he realizes that he's lying on the desert sand. And the Lord Krishna says to him, Narada, a half an hour ago I sent you out for a glass of water, and here I find you sleeping on the sand. And Narada says, oh Lord, I understand. Now, it's a beautiful analogy, isn't it? But all of us are out here, and we're engaged. We became enamored of one aspect of creation or another. Maybe it was a young man, a young woman, who knows? It happens to us over so many incarnations. So many different aspects of life draw us and promise us happiness. And the essence of confusion in life is this forgetfulness, that we lose track of what's really important. Just, I was talking of you last week of the fact that we just recently moved, and about 2 days ago, I put the last item away in the house. And it was astonishing to me how suddenly the whole reality of my life changed, because no longer was it a project. Suddenly I had a home again. And I thought to myself that what happened to me was that there was no point of rest, that I'd become accustomed to having a place in my life that was a point of rest. And now every time, until a few days ago when I went into my house, it was just another work site. And so there was this constant sort of sense of work. And I was joking with Patrick. I was saying, Master says to stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. And I wasn't able even to keep my equanimity just because my stuff was in boxes, right? You know, this ability that we have to transfer our sense of well-being to something outside of ourselves, whether it's the house or the relationship or the financial security or the health of the body, or the youth of the body, or whatever condition it is that we think we have to have, and then it slips away because we have forgotten that our true nature is complete within itself. Every week, for those of you who come, on Sunday mornings before the service starts, we have a meditation, and as part of that service, we do a fire ceremony and then we do a purification ritual. Purification ritual is very simple and in many ways much more intimate than many of the things that we do here. Every individual who chooses comes and kneels here in front of one of the light bearers and says a very simple phrase, I seek purification by the grace of God. Now, when Swamiji created this little ceremony, he described it as essentially, as he put it, in lieu of confession. That was how he actually put the little headline on it. It was a time when the Festival of Light was created and other rituals were being Swamiji was being inspired to create rituals for Ananda, which we'd never had any before. And his thought was to create rituals that were for Dwapara Yuga and not for the times in the past. About the Festival of Light, he commented, he said, it's a ritual that is not dependent on anything historical. It's celebrating the descent of spirit to liberate man from delusion, which is an ongoing reality throughout all of time. It's a timeless ritual. It's not the coming of Christ, the death of Christ, the breaking of bread with Christ, or any particular puja that's set to create this particular thing. It's just simply a ritual that continually celebrates the presence of God within us, the offering of ourselves into that light, and God's response. A prayer of love went up from earth and God responded. Many times has that light descended, drawn to earth by the call of aspiring love. God's chosen people have always been those of every race and nation who with deep love chose thee. I recall once when we performed that ritual for a woman who came here, I think she only came once. She was an Israeli Jew, and had very strong feelings, as many Israelis do, in defense of Judaism, which is an understandable attitude given the struggle that the Jews have had to have a homeland. And without being political about it, her attitude was understandable. And afterwards, she took me aside, and she was actually quite offended by what she felt was some kind of a disrespect for Judaism by saying, your chosen people have always been those of every race and nation. Because part of the fundamental idea of Judaism is this special covenant between God and the Jewish people. Now, broad-minded Jews don't mind that, but still she felt a little bit of a sneer in that. I was a little bit caught because her energy was very intense and I didn't want to upset her. At the same time, I needed to answer, and I prayed to Master, and the most interesting thought came to me. I said, oh my dear, every religion is, Swamiji counters cherished truths of every religion in the Festival of Light. You're just not familiar with the rest of them, so you didn't catch them. Okay? The only begotten, the infinite Christ consciousness. I mean, that's a very sensitive point. And there's a lot of others, if you read through it, that sort of touches on, because Swamiji is correcting a great many misunderstandings that narrowed religion instead of making it broad. My answer took her so aback that she just really didn't know what to say. She didn't know how to answer that because she didn't have enough knowledge to respond that we're also dismantling any sectarianism, including sectarianism in the Jews, but sectarian in Christians, sectarianism in Hindus, all of it, because it doesn't serve us to live in those narrow-minded ways. That's another form of forgetfulness. But in the purification ceremony, which is where I was coming to, what the words are, even the words purification itself, is a very interesting word. In the concept of confession, the basic concept is that we have done wrong, and we confess what we have done wrong, and hopefully the priest will absolve us of that. Master's comments, and Master never really spared people's feelings if he had a truth to say. He said, go to the priest with a stomach ache and see if he can absolve you of that. It was just a very sort of, you know, put it to a common sense test. He said, if the priest has the power to take away your karma, he can take away your karma, but if he can't take it away, don't be fooled. Now, of course, there's probably mitigating factors of faith and so on. I'm not here really, even though I seem to be starting to say insulting things about every established religion. But there's no future in that way of thinking. Purification approaches spirituality from a completely different angle. And that angle is our true nature is pure. And all we need to do is remove those impure things that have attached themselves to us. Gold covered with mud, a diamond buried in coal, is nonetheless exactly what it is, untouched by what has surrounded us. And so we as devotees are surrounded by this whole entourage of delusions that we carry around with us, starting, as I was saying last week, with our physical bodies and our egos and everything. And the purity of our simple inner nature has become confused because we've lived in these realities for so long, just like Narada, that we forgot that the Lord sent us out for a glass of water. In the beginning, the little bird is sent out on a divine mission. Be fruitful in what God has given you. Expand and multiply it. And what we have given, share with others. Just as we have shared with you. Just as God has given us the power of life, so our life is to share that which God has given us with all. Is there any limit to the degree to which we should share? No. Simply, the answer to that is no. Except that we have to move in realistic relationship to our own nature. And this peculiar reading today, which Swamiji describes when he talks about Jesus saying, "It cast not your pearls before swine, you know, let, or give not that which is sacred to dogs, cast not your pearls before swine." Swamiji describes it as the hearty give and take that a teacher had with his audience during that time. You know, when Jesus was teaching as a Jew in the Jewish synagogues, there was this tradition that there was a teacher's chair, and anyone really could come and sit in that chair and expound what he wanted to say, but then those who were listening had the right to argue back with him, and the Jewish people are very famous for their outspoken, strong opinions, and they would argue these truths back and forth, the orthodoxy versus the other, and they would quote scripture at one another, and so Jesus is in this, you know, discussion with people, this hearty give and take, and he characterizes those who are unable to grasp the highest truths as dogs and swine, not really a very kindly thing to say. And it also gives you more of a feeling of the force with which Jesus would speak. He wasn't careful about the way he spoke. He wanted it to be understood. But there's another aspect to that which is very interesting, which is not that we ourselves are dogs or swine, but we have to even be careful with ourselves that we not challenge and demand of ourselves more than we can do, because our own inner resistance to it will try to reject it, to try to protect the ego. It's not only that we have to work sensitively with other people's realities, we also have to work sensitively with our own. But it's a very, very fine line that we have to walk. And the essence of it comes down to this. I always tell people on the spiritual path, from the very beginning, the most important thing is not necessarily that you be perfect in everything that you set out to do. Because it's just really, quite frankly, an egotistical thought that's unrealistic. How can you possibly perfectly express these teachings? We've been swimming in the mud for a long time. We're Narada wandering in the village. We may be sincere in our aspiration, but a lot of impurities have crept into our thinking. Attachment to this, misunderstanding of that, an inability to function calmly when our stuff is in boxes. I mean, how small can that get? I felt, well, humbled is the only word you can think of. It's very good sometimes to just realize between what you say and how you actually respond, there's a big space. And it's good to be able to say what you can say. It's also necessary to be very, very honest about where we live and what our realities are. Because unless we are standing on firm ground, we're trying, as I put it sometimes, to work out someone else's karma. Because we don't even know what our own karma is, because we don't have the courage to just stand there and understand what it might be. So, but I was saying, when we start out on the spiritual path and all through the spiritual path, the most important thing is to develop right attitudes and habits and ways of regarding ourselves in the spiritual path that will serve us not only as beginners, but all the way to self-realization. And one of these is this balance point between recognizing where this path is really taking us and what God is really asking of us, and not being afraid of that, but also recognizing where I stand myself in relationship to that truth. Because there's a very, very great temptation. It's a very simple one, which is, because that mountain looks too high, I think I'll lower it. And that's really fundamentally what most religious teachings do, as Swamiji himself puts it. Even when they speak of the great quotes out of Jesus, I was reading this in Swami's Gita commentary last night. You know, the most expanded statements of Krishna, which really tell you that nothing in this world matters, and this world is a dream, and you will never, ever be happy, ever in this world. The Hindu priests have modified it. Oh, yes, it's good to have sons and have a family, and we'll do these rituals and we'll help you do that. And yes, Krishna says that, but family is also important. And in the Christian churches, Jesus says, be ye therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. And it's been modified down to be good and express goodness, and because it's just too much of a challenge. In other words, the masters stand at the pinnacle of self-realization and say, that which I am, as Jesus did, that which I have done, ye shall do in greater things. Jesus says, why do you call me a god? Don't you understand that ye too are gods? That this reality that is my self-realization is your self-realization. All you need to do is remember to purify yourself of those delusions which have crept in. But we don't really like that, as Swamiji put it. We don't appreciate the challenge. We don't enjoy the reproach. So what we do is we say, oh, that's not really what he meant. I recall having a conversation once with a Catholic, an Episcopal priest, a friend of mine. And I asked him some question about Christian church history. I'd been reading the Acts of the Apostles, and I thought, well, he has a theology degree from Yale. He's probably pretty good at this. So I asked him a certain question about Christian history. The answer he gave me was actually, this is what he actually said. He's a devotee of this path, and so I was able to speak frankly back to him. He said, well, Christianity developed over several centuries. Jesus just put down the foundation, but over the following centuries is when the teaching really gradually evolved. I said, really, think about what you just said. Jesus is a self-realized master with pure perception of God. He brings the truth. What you mean is over the next centuries, they killed it and just brought it into a lower and lower position until everybody felt comfortable with it. And then he sort of looked a little sheepish. And then he said a few things about what a disruptive influence I was on his life. And always had been. I mean, he's enjoyed the disruptive influence, but you know, I was happy the way I was until you showed up. But it was a good-natured jest. But isn't that so? Now, as individual devotees, we must be really, really careful about what we do. We must really never think that merely because I'm happy the way I am, that more happiness is not possible to me. Merely because the thought of something frightens me, we can't protect ourselves from that fear by pretending it's not really what Master said. It's that we can't lower the height of the Himalayas so that they seem less frightening to us. I had a very interesting experience when we went to Badrinath, which is about 11,000 feet in the Himalayas. We went 2 years ago for the first time. I'd never been in the mountains in that way, and I'd never driven up to 11,000 feet. We'd gone to Darjeeling before, but we flew much of the distance, and then even when we drove, interestingly, we drove at night, just because of the way the schedule works. So we ended up relatively high, but not nearly as high as 11,000 feet. And so I'm looking at high mountains. This time, we started on the flat ground, virtually. We started in Rishikesh, which is fairly low, relatively. And we just drove up, and we drove, and we drove, and we drove, and we drove. And in India, they allow things that no one would ever allow in this country. The road from Rishikesh to Josimath, which is 7,000 feet, is bad. The road from Josimath to Badrinath is unthinkable. It has no sides to it. It has overhanging rocks. It's one lane, and you have to back up and down to get over it. You overhang, and even those who are frightened of heights can never be secure because it switchbacks, and so the overhanging edge keeps changing. There's places where it says, do not stop because of falling rock, and then you have to wait there for a long time until the road clears. You know, there are times in India, there are times in all of life, but that more vividly in India, whether you really realize that my life is in God's hands, and what is the point? And it's so amusing, too, because, you know, America is based on the premise that we can control the external world, and if something happens, it's someone's fault, and I'll sue him. And there's always laws being made to protect us from ourselves. The whole Indian philosophy is completely different. It's karma. There's just not this thought that everybody has to be protected from everybody else. One of my friends who bought a car over there realized when he went to buy car insurance, it took him a little while even to understand it. Every individual insures their own vehicle and themselves. Period. And when there's any kind of a collision, you don't even exchange information. It doesn't make any difference. You have insured your car and yourself, and that's that. Even if you smashed up the other guy, it's his problem. He either has insurance or he doesn't, and you just walk away from it. That's why you see people there, they crash and they walk away. They don't get out and exchange business cards like we do, because it's not anybody else's relationship. It's just an interesting thought form. I don't even know if it's valid or even valid for the philosophical point, but it's interesting. But the point I was trying to make about the mountains is, so we drove up to the mountains, and what I observed is that there was no point at which the high mountains started. There was no point at which we were suddenly, Badrinath is considered to be one of the most sacred sites in all of India. It's actually where Baba, the image that they worship, which is a natural stone that Adi Shankara, one of the first Shankara, found in the ocean, in the river. It looks like this picture of Babaji. It's just a piece of rock, but it's shaped just like Babaji. And when you see it, it looks like Babaji. And everyone there considers it to be this Babaji. So it's very sacred to our path. And the whole origin of that particular shrine is related strongly to our path. But coming up, so that made it very sacred, not only in a general sense, but also specifically to followers of Master. Coming up this mountain, there was no point at which there was no line where we shifted over from being in the lowlands to the highlands. There was no line at which it became Babaji's territory instead of our territory. At a certain point, you realized you were someplace you'd never been before, but the transition was a seamless transition. Does that make sense? Now, nowadays, you can drive up to Badrinath, which we did. You can stay in a hotel when you're up there. But it used to be before that you had to walk. These were really, really remote pilgrimage places, and it would take you weeks, even months, to walk up those high mountains. And the yogis that lived up there were extremely inaccessible, and only the very dedicated could make it. There was a little temple and everything. There has been for centuries. Now you can just get in a car and go. But the walking was part of the journey, because you had to go up. Believe me, the car is pretty arduous too. But still, what struck me so powerfully was it was a perfect analogy of what our spiritual selves are like. We just start in one place, and slowly by slowly, with persistent, unrelenting effort, and it was a great effort for our pilgrimage group to get there. There were boulders on the road. We had to wait several days. We spent hours literally sitting in the hot sun by the road, waiting for them to get the rocks off, and then getting up that road was very difficult. It was arduous enough. I don't know what it would have been like to walk. But suddenly we were somewhere else. It was entirely different than where we started, but it was a seamless transition. Do you see what I mean? So what we have to understand is the highest form of spirituality, when the masters say, utterly selfish, selfless, stand unshaken amidst the crash of breaking worlds. Even the foxes have a hole that they call their own, but I, Jesus, the Son of Man, have no place to lay my head. This particular one, in the most ridiculous way, has become so vivid to me. You read that so often and you think, for the freedom of being a wandering sadhu, and I lose my little home for 1 month. And I discover that my whole sense of self is just fragmented. And I think, Divine Mother, we have so long to go, don't we? So much grace is required. And as I said last week, driving down the freeway, and I think something's going to happen to my little body, and all of this sort of tension comes up. Somebody doesn't respect me, and I get this sense of great huffiness. All of these little ways. And it's so tempting to find justification for it, isn't it? Well, he was wrong too. He shouldn't have treated me that way. He really has something to learn. I'm going to be the one who tells him. All these different ways in which the ego says, I don't want to go that high. I don't want to climb that mountain. Now, that's where we have to be careful with ourselves. That's what I was saying. We don't want to be the swine who trample these pearls in the dust. We have to have the courage to say, that's the pearl of great price. And it will be a seamless ascension for me. Someday that will be mine. And in the meantime, I'll enjoy these flowers. I'll enjoy this meadow. I'll love this little rose that I'm holding in my hand, but it's the pearl of great price that I seek. And with my whole heart, let me love and respect it and pray to God every day to give me both the courage, the understanding, the devotion, and the determination to realize that which is truly mine.
Let us make our offer.